make a difference in the world and what we call Be Ninja and, you know, listen, learn, improve, repeat and all of these. And they're really key for the teams on the ground, really key. But when I'm going further up the chain, the first thing I have to do is knock off, can they actually manage and drive and grow a good profit business?
Elaine Jobson has been doing fitness for almost as long as fitness has been around. She spent 30 years working around the globe. She's worked in the UK, she's worked in South Africa, she's worked in Malaysia. She's now in Australia and she's the CEO of Jets Fitness, which is a franchised fitness model. So they've got gyms in Australia, gyms in the UK, Thailand, and they're off on their journey in India. But today I want to chat to her about her book, High Performance Through Happy People. Fabulous book, absolutely filled with actionable things that you can do to build culture. And we dig into some of why that matters today. She wants to make sure the basics get covered. So she implemented Net Promoter Score at Jets, having seen how that had transformed Virgin in South Africa. She used Fred Reichel to do that, a guest on this show. Their Net Promoter Score at Jets is in the 70s. So if you know anything about Net Promoter Score, you know that that's world class and hard to do. And we chat through some of the things that make the service layer in the gym the stickiness, because they don't have contracts. So there's something about how they've taken their gyms to market and how they've built an employee value proposition, put these two things together and build sticky businesses that scale. So fantastic to pick Elaine's brains for half an hour or so. I love chatting to her. I'm sure you'll love it too.
My name's Elaine Jobson. I'm the CEO and Managing Director of Jets Fitness down in Australia.
Elaine, to some context, how big is Jets?
We're a global brand. So we're Australia born and bred. So we've been here for 17, nearly 18 years. And we've got 130-something gyms here. We've got, we're also in New Zealand. We're in Thailand. We're in the Netherlands, the UK, and soon to be in India. We're just about to launch in India.
Does that feel like it's new territory for you? Is the Indian market a nascent market for gyms?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the India's had gyms for many, many years. Fitness First actually went into India 20 years ago. But it's been up and coming, and it's really now, it's right on the cusp of its growth. But rising middle class, you know, the technologies, property was always a challenge in India, trying to get property with landlords that you could deal with on large amounts of property. You'd often get them where there was lots of individual families owning lots of little bits of the property, and you had to kind of amalgamate them all together. Whereas that's all being fixed now by, you know, shopping centers and, you know, big developments happening. So yeah, it's about to boom, the fitness market over there. So we're very happy to have some master franchise partners that are going to be helping us expand over there. So yeah, very exciting.
How long have you been the CEO?
I've been the CEO of Jets now for 8 years. I've been here for 12 years. And okay. Yeah, originally started with the founder of Jets. You know, the business is about 5 years old. And as founders do, you know, he did a great job of kind of, you know, he hit with the right kind of product at the right kind of time. And it was chaos. You know, he was opening, I think, a club a week at that time. Uh-huh. And, you know, after 5 years of scrambling with the growth, they just wanted some help to kind of stabilize things, get some systems in place. And obviously, competition was coming into the market. So Brendan Levinson, he's called. I came and joined Brendan to help just kind of, you know, putting those kind of mature business systems and processes and just make sure that we're kind of ready for kind of maximizing the growth going forward. So, yes. And then, yeah, we're also preparing the business to sell, which we did. We sold to a large private equity in Australia. And at that point, I took over as CEO. So that was back in 2017.
So 2017, how many people, what was the turnover when Brendan exited?
Yeah, well, the Jets is a business. We turn over 100 million across the network. You know, it's a big business. Yeah, strategically, we've kind of changed. We've owned some clubs because we're a franchise business. But we say sometime, you know, under the previous leadership of the private equity, we owned a lot of our clubs. And since then, we've kind of reduced that ownership portfolio and lent back into franchising. So it's kind of amalgamated and changed over the years, but yeah, it's been a great business, still very successful, still a very strong brand in Australia.
So you're now, what proportion of your business is franchise?
The vast majority of it.
Vast majority.
Yeah. I mean, we've got about 10% of the clubs that we own. But we're fundamentally a franchise business. We do international franchising as well. Obviously, we've got a very successful business in the UK, which is going really well. Those guys are growing out of London and, funny enough, in Yorkshire as well.
Okay. And when you came in, though, it was 100%. Jets owned all the gyms when you arrived?
Yeah, as I say, it's franchise. But yes, Brendan and a couple of smaller investors owned the business and, yeah, sold it to Quadrant Private Equity here in Australia.
Fab. So your book covers what you've learned along the way. You mentioned Fitness First. You've worked with many of the big gym chains. Where did you start? Who did you start with?
Where did I start in the fitness industry? That was a long time ago. And I think I actually started in the fitness industry before it was even an industry. It was, I started in a very, very small gym on a high street in Hull. Can you believe it? That's the very, very first gym I worked in. But yeah, I started at Fitness First really early in the Fitness First journey. Mike Balfour, who is the founder there, started with the concept of, you know, making fitness really accessible to you know, the everyday person, and did that by removing all of the kind of expensive things like swimming pools and jacuzzis and saunas, and just kind of concentrated on just having the gym offering and made it really affordable. And it just took fire. I mean, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, we were opening a gym every 4 days. We owned them all. So that was a crazy time. And yeah, well, I was one of the kind of early employees in that business, you know, working for Mike. And yeah, we were growing at such a rate that we were taking on jobs we had no clue what we were doing. You know, we were just having to figure it out on the fly. I think I got promoted to European sales director because I happened to have spent a year or so in France when I was a teenager and happened to know the most French. So that was me appointed into European sales director role. And yeah, we just kind of, yeah, so we did 530 gyms in 10 years across 12 countries. It was a great school fees for me, you know, great opportunity to learn the business and to learn, you know, from an amazing entrepreneur.
You were then primarily in a sales role.
I always was. I mean, I kind of fell into it. And I talk about being in a sales role, and I didn't think I was in a sales role at the beginning. I just loved, I'm kind of like remembering, like, sat on this reception counter, and where our first gym was like, you know, you could kind of had a glass door and you could see the high street, and you kind of see these people. It's a women's only gym. So you see these women kind of like walking along, and then they would get to outside the front of the gym, and then they would kind of go to go in and then hesitate and then obviously lose their courage and walk away, because it's quite intimidating, you know, to walk into a gym. And I just fell in love with the process of, you know, if that person got enough bottle to walk in, I didn't want to lose them. I wanted them to kind of go on this path to being healthier and fitter. And I really valued that and honed the skill of how do I influence them to do that and to not waste this opportunity of them walking in and giving me the opportunity to kind of convert them into a new lifestyle. I never really thought about it as a sales job, to be honest, at that time. But I remember kind of, you know, as time went by, and I did live in Hull originally, and I moved to Leeds because I wanted to live in a bit of a bigger city. And I remember kind of reading the Yorkshire Post at the back of the Yorkshire Post and the, you know, the recruitment adverts, and seeing a job ad for a membership sales consultant for a gym chain, and thinking, oh my God, this is actually a job I could do, and applying for it. And that's when I moved to Leeds and never looked back. But, you know, I kind of fell into like a membership sales role. That was another kind of a little bit crazy entrepreneur who was at that point. If you read the job advert, it sounded like he had an empire, but he actually only had two small gyms open in Scotland. And he was trying to open a third one in Leeds. And I arrived, and it was just like two chairs and a table. Like, that was all we had, or all I had, to kind of sell memberships from. And he trained me in how to actually do sales as a skill. And, you know, we were very kind of heavily scripted and all of that. And yeah, and I loved it. I don't think I could sold anything else. Like, I'm a very good salesperson at selling memberships. I'm not sure I'd be really good at selling cars or something, but it's such an amazing opportunity.
You're more of a missionary around the around this stuff. Just going back to your story about the woman on this high street coming to the door and then not coming in. Why women's only gym? So you already meant there was no blokes in there. And then maybe you have also made it easier as you've gone on and worked in other gyms. So what do you think was in that woman's mind or those women's minds when they're thinking, I can't come in here? And what have you done to fix that over time so that it is just welcoming and not as intimidating?
We've done our best to make that easier. I'm not sure whether it is completely. It's a human thing. You know, I think when people walk into gym, and I don't think it actually matters whether it's a female or a male, they walk in and or they imagine walking in and they imagine seeing an unbelievably fit people. This is what's in their mind, you know, before they walk in, like there's going to be amazingly fit people. They're all going to be better looking than me. They're all going to be fitter and slimmer and whatever than me. And the reality is that nobody's like that in the gym.
Yeah.
Everybody's there for a reason, but it's just, you know, we have this fear that, you know, of the unknown, and the unknown they paint in their mind is this, you know, image of everybody being super beautiful and perfect. And they soon realize, I mean, I say they soon realize, but I think actually also what happens is when somebody walks into a gym, you might have 20, you know, dad bods on the gym floor, but they'll spot that one really ripped abs guy and look, oh my god, like I was totally right, look, they're all really really fit. So it's just something about health and fitness and the gym and industry, and it's a journey we've definitely been on of trying to, I'm on the AusActive board, which is our peak body board here, and something we're really aware of is changing the image of the industry. And it actually showed up a lot in COVID, because, you know, obviously we were shut down as everybody else was, and for a very long time. And it, you know, it was because we kept getting classified as kind of with restaurants and bars and strip clubs and all sorts of things. We were in that bracket of almost entertainment and hospitality, whereas, you know, we're good for mental health, and, you know, we're good for physical health. And, you know, we've come out the back of that, really understanding the need to kind of change the image of the industry into, you know, and it actually has happened by default. Like our members now, there is many members joining for mental health reasons as there is for physical health reasons. And that's changed dramatically. And there's less of the kind of selfie taking Instagram behaviors, and a little bit more now leaning into people just wanting things like longevity and to have kind of the wellness feel. So it's a lifelong battle. I'm not even sure within my career we'll see the full change of that. But, you know, those selfie images are strong, and you know, the scrunchy bum shorts that they like to wear in the gym aren't going to go away anytime soon. But we can but fly the flag for the importance of health and fitness and wellness, you know.
I was just thinking about your franchise model now. If I wanted to buy one of your franchises, what do I get? I get your brand. And, you know, is it sort of zero to hero? If I've never run a gym before, can I buy a Jets franchise and it's like, you do it all for me? What? I'm just curious.
Yeah,
I'm not looking to buy a gym anytime soon, but I'm just curious. I was talking to somebody the other week, an entrepreneur the other week, and we were talking about health and fitness, and she said, well, where I lived, there was no gyms. I said, oh, what did you do? She said, well, I bought a CrossFit franchise and opened my own gym. And it was just like, oh, of course you did, because that's what everybody would do. And so I'm just curious. I didn't ask her what you got, but, you know, now I've got an expert. Like, what do you get if you buy a gym franchise?
Yeah. Like, I think first and foremost, you know, for people that buy Jets aren't necessarily people that want to actually work in the gym.
Okay.
90 to 95% of our gyms are run by club managers. They're not run by the owners. I mean, we do have people that actually own it and run it. That does work as well. But yeah, a lot of them. So you are thinking about investment. You'd think about people that want to invest in the concept. And so from an investor mindset, why would they choose to invest in a gym? There's many reasons, but there's a lot to do with our model is a reoccurring revenue stream that actually gives, you know, investors a lot of confidence, because you've got that income coming in every single month without fail. And, you know, when you think about your alternative of owning a Subway or a KFC or something, and then you're going, well, you've got to kind of resell those products over and over again, it becomes very comforting to have that. So that's a strong reason why people will buy a gym. It's a growing market. It's, you know, for those that do their research, you know, the fitness industry has been growing exponentially for a long time and continues
forever
to do so. Yeah, exactly. And we aren't done yet.
And what do you look at? You know, you said you were looking to open one in Leeds. So do you do the research and say, this is the demographics in Leeds, this is the population of certain age group? What's your, what And in our target market, if we put one here, we reckon there's enough people that would make it viable. Is that you do all that in advance, or does the franchisee do that?
We tend to do that here. There's different models of franchising. We tend to do that ourselves. We're what we call property-led. So we'll generally, we have two different versions of software that do very similar things, and it's because we can cross-check each. And it will look at the demographic profiling of obviously a typical Jets member, and it will look at where the competition is. And, you know, it's pretty clever software. It'll identify where the key places are, and not just right now, but growing into the future. So kind of, you know, greenfield developments that are happening with a lot of kind of new suburbs, it will kind of locate those. And then it will show us where we should be looking. And then we have a kind of leasing manager will go out and actually look for property in that area. Then that will give us something to say, does somebody want to take this property over? Obviously, we have a lot of multi-owners, so people that are already in the network system that will go, they'll want that one because it's down the road from their other one. And, you know, they'll kind of grow their own kind of territory out.
What makes a Jets gym different to anybody else? And I suppose it might be different in different countries because your competitors are different in each country. But why are you different? What makes you special?
Yeah, I think if you came to Jets here, because you've got, you know, Jets, you've got Anytime, you've got Snap, you've got some similar kind of concepts. We're all 24-hour suburban-based concepts, fitness concepts. What's different for us is, you know, we call ourselves a good profit business, so we don't do any contracts at all. So we don't, sometimes people say they do a no locking contract, but actually there is a 30-day notice period. So we very much commit to no hidden fees, no locking contracts. And we invest in heavily, and as you can see from the book, in culture. So we double down on the service experience, and we have done that for many years now. So we're kind of known for that. So if somebody's going to choose Jets over another option, it would be because they value the experience, like going in and it feeling friendly, going in and being supported and cared for. And that's the trust that comes with the brand that won't necessarily be in some of the competitors.
I've had Hurst Schultz on, who was one of the founders at Ritz-Carlton, you know, and, you know, most of these hotel chains, I know people say, oh, you know, Airbnb, they don't own any property. Well, most of the hotel companies don't own the property either. And I guess what you're saying is most of the gym brands don't own it either. They've got Ritz-Carlton have a way of hiring, or certainly did before they were acquired. But, you know, they would go and hire a certain type of person, and then they train them so that the experience was right. So I'd love to dive into some of the specifics in the book. Oh, I should put it up behind me. There's an empty slot there. It's because I was talking about it before. We were recording. Love to get some specifics from Jets. But even if you want to go back, and there's some stories from your turnaround in Virgin South Africa, which sounds, the fact that you got rid of 40% of the leaders, I think you said, I was on a mission, and I was prepared to go as deep as I needed to get to that inflection point. So obviously we share this common belief that the behavior of the employees is down to the day-to-day management and leadership. So how do you do that culture thing then in Jets so that if I go into a Jets in Yorkshire, it feels right?
Yeah. And I do know you will get that in Jets and Yorkshires with those guys recently. They're amazing team there. if you asked that question 10 years ago, I couldn't have guaranteed you that, to be honest. I couldn't have said you go into every single Jets and feel the same. But because we've been at it for so long, it's become the way we do things. It's a part of the DNA, and like attracts like. So, you know, as we've grown and expanded, you know, our international master franchise partners, we don't just bring in anybody. We obviously put them through the rigor of making sure that we're culture and values aligned. And then they go and recruit people like themselves. So we, you know, we're able to now kind of have that as the DNA stick running through everybody. But you have to build that, and it takes a long time, and you have to keep reinforcing it. And of course, as the ultimate kind of leader of the business, I hold the line on it. You know, that's the leadership bit. I mean, leadership is a lot of it. And I have to make sure I don't have to do as much day to day as I used to. It was like 90% of my time a decade ago. It's you know, 10% of my time now. But yeah, it's just making sure the leadership's in place. And for as long as the leadership's in place, and it gives the permission to the business to be what we want it to be, and what we promote it to be, and what we train people to be, it will be. But it has to have the permission of the leadership.
And so you said we are like attracts like, so we hire for culture. dig into that a little bit. Like, what does that look like? Because people say all the time, oh, hire for attitude, train for skill. And then I say, well, what do you do? And they look at me like, well, I've said what we do. We hire for attitude, but they don't have a process behind it. So what's your, maybe we could get some of that process.
Yeah. Well, in the more senior positions, whether it be an international partner, I am heavily involved in that recruitment. And the same goes for any of our senior leadership team as well, because the responsibility is so immense in those roles that if you get that one wrong, you're never going to be able to correct it. And, you know, I was actually listening to one of your podcasts, was it with Jade? And, you know, talking about values and virtues. And of course, you can't get people to change their values. Their values are set. But it's incredibly important that you go and pick people that share the same values already with what you're looking to create. You can't bring somebody in and go, here's the values, go and be that. You actually have to go and find those values through the filter of the brand and then being able to bring them in. And what does that look like? Look, we don't have, obviously, you know, when it comes to our club managers and a bit lower level, we have a filter of, you know, how we interview and, you know, how we attract those people in. But at the senior level, we just spend time, you know, we spend a lot of time with people and in different circumstances, like when our India partners, when we were, you know, because they say, I think about things almost like a relationship. It's like a date, you know, first date, second date, third date. And, you know, we do all sorts of things. You know, we'll have a formal meeting and then we'll go out and have drinks and then we'll have dinner and then we'll go to the zoo together. And because people can't hold a facade up for a long time, the more comfortable they get, the more they'll reveal. So we just invest an awful lot of time in people, just making sure that we understand what their values are. And they don't need to, you know, be exactly like us. We're not looking for that, but they do need to believe what we believe. And if they don't believe what we believe, then we can't take it forward.
What are Jet's values?
Well, when I say believe in good profit is the most important thing for us. So the belief of good profit, and obviously good profit being, you know, profit that's made at the enhancements of a relationship with our customer and our people, not at the detriment. That's so key for those kind of high level roles, because if we don't get that right, they're going to make decisions that we're going to fall out over. So, for example, you know, let's take the India team. If they decided that, well, actually, we're going to put contracts in because everybody else in all our competitors have got contracts, that might be something that they think they're going to make more revenue from, because obviously locking people in to a contract, you're going to make more money because they can't get out. Yep. But obviously the devastation that creates to the brand and the customer experience over time is not what we believe in. So that's where we're going to fall out. So it's really important that I make sure that they believe in the concept of good profit, because there is going to be times when you're so immensely tempted to do a bad profit decision, especially when you're in charge of the financials of a business, and they need to have the strength to say no to those things in the view of longevity of the business. So those are the things that we have to really check for. And obviously, you know, we've got values of, you know, make a difference in the world and, you know, being what we call being ninja and, you know, listen, learn, improve, repeat, and all of these. And they're really key for the teams on the ground, really key. But when I'm going further up the chain, the first thing I have to do is knock off, can they actually manage and drive and grow a good profit business?
So listen, learn,
improve, repeat.
How does that show up every day? If I'm an employee in your business, what rituals or processes have you got around that to bring that to life?
Yeah. So listen, learn, improve, repeat actually came in with our net promoter score.
Right. What's your net promoter score?
It's over 70 consistently. It's
world class. Well done. That is outstanding. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to get. It's hard to do well.
It's very hard. So we put that into the business about 8 years ago. And I was so fortunate when I was at Virgin Active in South Africa. We were the first gym chain to actually do net promoter. And I got the opportunity to work with Fred Reichheld on that to understand how to actually translate what was effectively a hospitality and retail orientated survey into a gym environment, because our environment is quite different. You've got, you know, the transaction kind of happens once and then it happens behind the scenes. It's not like they have to keep repeat purchasing every time they walk in the gym. It's quite intimate because we see our members quite often. So, and as I say, it's just different. So we need to understand how to do it in our environment. And Fred helped me do that. And then when I came to Jets, you know, one of the first things I wanted to do is put NPS in place because I wanted a measure, I wanted a score of where we're starting from. And the teams had no concept of what NPS was. And you have to run it. NPS is not a survey. It's a philosophy. It's a way that you run the business. And the best way we could do it is create the value of listen, learn, improve, repeat, because, you know, we do what's called closed loop NPS. So, you know, we have the feedback, then that comes back to the club manager, and the club manager has to act upon that, fix that issue, feedback to the member, and then we survey again and close the loop. And I wanted to make sure that was in place. So listen, learn, improve, repeat was the value that carried NPS as a strategy into the business, and it lives in that value.
Let me interrupt the conversation just for a minute because I don't want you to miss this. My new book, Mind Your Fucking Business, is out on Amazon. If you're thinking yet another business book, I think you're wrong. This is actually a blueprint to cutting through the noise and achieving unparalleled success for you. It's based on 10 years of business coaching, spotting similar problems that people have had and coming up with real world solutions. If it's supercharging sales, if it's mastering talent acquisition, building a powerhouse brand, cultivating a company culture that breeds success, then this book is a ticket to your transformative journey. It's filled with practical tools and frameworks that I use every single day with my clients as part of their coaching program. If you want to take your business from good to great, look, you can go to Amazon and you can buy it, or you can click the link in the show notes and head over to monkhouseandcompany.com. I'll send it to you today. I'll send you a copy for free. I want to help you build a fantastic business. Now, back to the conversation. You know, you've got a recurring revenue business, but you're not on contract. So what are some of the things that through that listen, learn, improve. Improve, repeat. That's right. What are some of the things that you have found which, I don't know, maybe they're counterintuitive, that drive the recurring revenue? Because you've got to stay on top of it, because if something's broken, you know, you'll start to bleed members really quickly.
Yeah, and it's a really good point. So when this will happen in any business, not just ours, but when you first put NPS in, what it highlights for you very quickly is all the detractors. So all the detractor comments. But when you get a detractor comment, it's effectively somebody pointing out where you're not delivering on the expectation that was set at the beginning. So a classic for us would be like the air conditioning doesn't work. Like you come into an environment, uh-huh. You're going to be comfortable. Now the air conditioner doesn't work, detractor, because you're just not delivering on the basics. So we created a strategy that was called the Brilliant Basics. And we actually identified all of the basic expectations that our members have. So it's everything from a clean club to being able to access at 2 a.m. in the morning if they wanted to with a fob, through to it's going to be safe. It's a safe environment. You know, all of those steps we identified. And then we set out to build the systems and processes to deliver those 100% of the time. So the intention that we had was that there's certain things in life you cannot get wrong at all. So if you think about, you know, you're working in air traffic control at Heathrow, you can't go, do you know what? We go home that night. I did amazing today. I got 98% of the planes landed okay. But I put 20
in,
put 20 into the tarmac. But hey ho, you know, that's a pretty good score. And I think about, you know, all of those options in life where you can't fail. And I think businesses like ours are not always really good at being that passionate and obsessed by delivering the basics really, really well. So that's where we started with our strategy all those years ago. And we're just really obsessed over that. And that's what moved us the highest. When our first ever NPS score was like 32. It was pretty low.
Yeah.
And we moved it the most by just fixing the basics and just that rigor around, you know, just say 100% delivery of what the expectation is of the member. Customers don't always need a lot. They just want what they think they're paying for. And,
yes.
You know, delivering that is a great place to start for every business.
Is the person that drives that, because there's a book called Unreasonable Hospitality, which I really like. And one of the phrases in there is nothing great has been done by reasonable people.
Yeah.
And so that sort of obsession about the basics, does the club manager then become absolutely the key person? You know, I remember when I was at one business, I went in to run a call center, and the guy who was running the call center said, oh, let me show you around. And as we went in the door, there's sort of three phone books at the bottom of the stairs covered in dust. And I'm like, yeah, I don't need to have a look around. I know everything about the way you're running this business. He's like, what do you mean? I said, well, you've come past these three phone books for months. They're covered in dust. Like, this place will be a shambles. I don't need to see it. You know, that just, it feels like that basics thing, you know, the club manager needs to just spot all of,
yes,
all those
yes,
things.
For sure. Although, I mean, our clubs are open 24 hours a day and our club managers are only in them for 8 hours a day.
Okay.
So a lot of that delivery is actually in the systems and processes that sit outside of them. So it's a lot to do with our maintenance teams, with our equipment partners, with all of the support structure that goes on the outside. What you're talking to is actually the second strategy we led on top. So once we kind of felt we'd nailed the brilliant basics and kind of, you know, squeeze that lemon out as much as we could in our NPS, we then moved on to the second strategy, which was what we called, we've got crazy names for these things, so don't judge me, but we called it Unleash Your Inner Ninja. And that was actually taking the people part and layering on the service on top of that. So the human experience. And what we use is Maslow's hierarchy. So we think about Maslow's and that the base of Maslow's being safety and security. For us, that was the brilliant basics. That was just giving people, making people feel safe and secure in the environment. The second part of that was making people feel they belong. So that's when we kind of activated our ninjas, have been our club managers. And that's where we have the value be ninja. That's where it came from. And we wanted them to start to really, you know, kind of unleash them and give them the permission to be able to do these kind of really wow service experiences and to kind of show what they're actually already very powerful at. They're all fitness professionals. None of them are salespeople by trade. They're all, you know, fitness qualified. And we wanted to kind of unleash them. And that's what kind of took us to that next level, which, you know, is like giving people the permission to give great service and be creative is where the magic happened.
What are some of those guidelines or that you give people? Like, what is it? They can spend money. They can put in time. What are the things that you're asking them to deliver to guests or clients?
Yeah. Well, the first thing we do is we have the value of the golden rule. So the golden rule being, you know, treat others as you like to be treated. So it's the age old biblical golden rule that's, you know, been around for a long, long time. And the reason we gave them that is that the guardrails is because we didn't want to script them. We didn't want to kind of put these kind of parameters in place. We just said, look, if you've got somebody in front of you and you're reading a situation, and let's say that it's a rule that we've got in place. I mean, I know when I was a virgin, we had this situation at a reception that I actually watched it unfold in front of me where, you know, the reception was really busy and there was a long queue of people trying to get in, and the receptionist had to, if somebody wasn't a member of the club, then she'd have to take them through all the paperwork and the, you know, the insurance disclaimers and whatever. And this lady was stood there holding this baby and the baby was screaming and it was all really tense. And she was, and this receptionist was like, oh my goodness, I've got to actually get her to sign this paperwork. And she said, you know, like, she just let her through and let her go and sit in the lounge. And then calmly kind of gave her the paperwork and said, look, when your baby's come, here's your paperwork, you can complete it. And it's that if you empower your team with the golden rule to say, look, just, you know, what would you want to have happen to you in this situation? Then they have the permission to be able to go and do it when you have a value like that, as opposed to having to give them big books of training as to, you know, well, in this situation, do that. And in that situation, do this. We just wanted to kind of empower them and trust them and say, we've recruited the right people here. Just go do you, but do it within that. If you have to stand in front of me and explain, well, this is what, you know, the situation was, and this is what I would have wanted to happen, you're good. You know, that's the rule, the golden rule.
There is some tension because, you know, there's some people will end up the wrong side of that line. How do you then make sure that there is no sort of, because you don't want them to be punished in any way. It's like, you know, maybe that wasn't the right thing to do, but, you know, good on you for trying. And how do you nuance that?
Yeah. Well, actually, what's quite amazing, whenever I've gone into a business and done this, you know, I've kind of deployed them to go do this, you know, let's, you know, break some rules. Because, you know, like when I was at Virgin, the previous ownership of the company, obviously that was an acquisition, the previous ownership had put a lot of rules in place. It was almost like the team were crippled by the amount of rules they had. And when I said, hey guys, you know, we don't have to do this anymore. Here's the golden rule. Just operate within that. They couldn't. It's like a muscle they'd never used. And I actually had to go around the business finding examples of them breaking a rule, the smallest little thing, and then blowing that up on the kind of, you know, the intranet, going, oh my God, like this person did this and look what they did. And that was how it helped the member. It's actually the reverse. You know, people are frightened of breaking rules most of the time. And I would accept the 1% that will abuse it for getting the 99% activated into actually doing more of that. And the culture holds them. You know, ultimately, the culture will spit out anybody who's not aligned with the culture. We can rely on that now. But yeah, it's actually the reverse issue. It's trying to get them to actually be brave.
That overcoming learned helplessness is fascinating. You go back, you know, I was doing some work for a global business recently where, you know, it had been run, founder owned and operated, and very command and control. And none of the people on the senior leadership team had actually been in, I mean, this is the 80 people global leadership team. None of them had been in place when the owner founders had been there. And yet they obviously behaved some way, they behaved in a particular way. They came here, but because they normalized to the culture really quickly, and the CEO said, look, I need to change the way we do organizational, you know, strategic planning, like bottom up, not top down, because everybody's sitting around waiting for me to tell them what to do. Like, even if that's never how they behaved somewhere else, it's like really odd that a culture can get stuck in a business, even if nobody was there when the culture got set. It's fascinating. How much did you just have to keep banging on, and how much of that workload was then offset by the 40% new leaders you brought in to Virgin? Because Malcolm Gladwell, in his new book, Revenge of the Tipping Point, reckons about 30% is the tipping point. And I talk about in my book about an experiment done by a bank in Yorkshire where, again, the manager from one branch came to best branch to worst branch, and he had to bring a third of his staff with them to get this sort of critical mass. I wasn't surprised that you had to go as deep as 40, but you were able to keep bring them in and do that culture transition?
Yeah, the two ran in parallel, and it was because the lack of empowerment, the fear was living at the ground. You know, that was at the cold face of the business. So I had to be the one going in and saying, you have permission. And I spent a lot of time in the clubs, like a lot of time, and catching them doing it right. And as I celebrating that behavior, because I was fighting a lot of the poor leadership that was actually using a lot of that fear management to deliver what they wanted, which was, you know, it was quite convenient for them, for people to be acting in fear because they did as they were told. But that wasn't an empowered environment. So the two had to have, you know, had to actually happen at the same time. And they're not always easy to spot, you know, these people, especially your kind of, you know, say the fugitives that live in the middle. And you know, you have to go quite deep, but you have to be so tenacious at removing them. And you'll kind of remove the most obvious ones, and then you'll think the job is done. And just as you think the job is done, you'll find another layer. And you have to keep going. And I had to almost have this image in my mind that I was like a dog with a bone. Like, I am not going to give up. You will quit before I do. And I think you have to have that kind of commitment to the tenacity it takes to actually, if I am the only person standing running this company, so be it. I'll get casuals in. I'll get some. It's like, I don't care. They just had to know that I was never going to. They either fitted in, they changed the behavior and accepted, or they had to leave. There was going to be no other outcome. And I think once that kind of that critical mass is like tipped, and they can see that I wasn't going anywhere, and I was not going to be forgiving on this, then, you know, some did feel like, you know, you get your kind of passes in the middle did come over. But yeah. And as soon as you see it again, then you've got to take it out, and you've got to be so quick with that.
One of the stories I've heard you tell is around putting healthcare benefits into Virgin Active South Africa, and the impact that had. Maybe you could tell that story very quickly, because I thought it was a very powerful story.
Yeah, I'll try and tell it quickly, because it was a little bit of a amount of things that happened. It was actually born on me not having any success. So I was brought into Virgin Active to help change the culture around. I didn't realize at the start. I thought I was going to enjoy this Virgin culture, but then I quickly realized I was actually having to to change the culture to be a virgin company because of its heritage. And, you know, it'd come from being run by a bunch of gangsters that had been caught embezzling money out of the country and gone into liquidation. And obviously that's when, you know, Richard had got involved, or Nelson Mandela had got involved and, you know, saw the plight of the company and had contacted Richard. And famously, you know, Richard had, you know, Joan Rich's wife had answered the phone and run with the phone into the bathroom where Richard was lying naked in the bath, and, you know, took the phone call and had Nelson Mandela explain about what was going on with this business in South Africa and this gym chain that was, you know, everyone's going to lose their jobs because it obviously the gangsters had all been swept up by the police and arrested, and the company gone into liquidation. So so Richard had agreed to kind of take this business on and had done what he always does, which he sends in like the Virgin management team from the UK, and they arrive and they give them the uniforms and they change all the branding and give them all the training and then kind of leave again. And then over time, he could hear these horror stories kind of coming out, these cultural horror stories. There was, you know, just bullying and, you know, bad culture. And he eventually changed out the whole C-suite. And that's when I was brought into the company as the chief operating officer. And I kind of came in with the Virgin brand as permission, hey? So I had, you know, lots of opportunity to bring in, you know, get your birthday off from you, you know, for free, and free breakfast in the morning. There was loads of these initiatives that you could do it, but it was making no difference to the culture. It was like, I would do the little surveys and we'd get like nothing back. And I was like losing my mind of what do we have to do here to make people happy? So I ended up doing what I do best, because I kind of came up from the gym floor. So I go back to the gym floor and spend some time in the gym, you know, trying to understand what is going on here. The gym's had like 50 employees. They're not small places. Yeah. And it was on one of those shifts that I was with the club manager, and the maintenance guy came up to me and up to both of us, and he'd gashed his arm. So he'd slipped with his screwdriver, he'd put it into his arm, and he was bleeding quite badly, and he definitely needed stitches. So we shipped him off to the hospital. And then a couple of days went by, and I went back down into the gym to check on him and, you know, how is he doing? And they hadn't seen him since we'd shipped him off to the hospital. I was like, well, that's not good. That's not good enough. That's not good culture. We need to go and make sure he's okay. So, you know, me leading from the front, let's go and jump in the car and go to his house and check on him. So we did. And, you know, a lot of the team lived in townships. They didn't live in houses like, you know, like we do. And we eventually got into the township and found, you know, by shouting out his name, and, you know, eventually found where he lives, and they hadn't seen him. So we tracked him back to the hospital and went into the hospital and been told that he'd gone into intensive care, which was just, you know, we couldn't understand what was going on because he just had a gash in his arm. And what had happened was he'd gone to the hospital. He'd been sitting in the waiting room for almost now 3 days. His wound had gone septic. He'd got septicemia and gone into a heart failure because he was blood poisoning, being rushed up to intensive care. And he'd actually ended up having his arm amputated from the elbow down. And this all kind of happened in front of me and effectively on my shift. And it was that I went back to the team and the club and went, what the heck, you know, how did that happen? And, you know, and we just all kind of sat down and they said, well, it's straightforward for us. You know, we wait when we go to the hospital. We don't get the privilege of walking in and seeing somebody straight away because we don't have medical aid is like a basic healthcare, which in South Africa, it's like all companies give that to their employees, but it's not mandatory. And we didn't know about it because obviously we were a British company coming in, and the previous gangster owners had never put it in. But obviously, you know, as soon as Virgin understood that, they put it in place for everybody. And that was radical. Like that was effectively, I was losing 2 people a month to AIDS and TB. Employees, wow. Because the disease was so rife, and those are people that couldn't afford to go to the doctors, they couldn't afford the meds, so suddenly they had that security for themselves and for their family members, and the happiness just rocketed. And that's not something I'm particularly proud of, because we should have figured that out earlier, but it just goes to show that kind of Maslow's is a real thing. You know, when people don't feel safe and secure, they do not care about your birthday off, or they don't care about the foosball table or the free breakfast. You have to make sure they feel safe. And that's why whenever I go into a company now, the first thing I do is, do our people actually feel safe and secure? That's the starting point always.
Brilliant. What did it cost the company to put that in place?
I think it was about £7 million.
Wow.
Per annum.
And so, I mean, it comes back to your commitment to profit, good profit versus bad profit. you know, I could see some conversations around boardroom tables, people going, £7 million for,
yeah,
you know, so well done for fighting that corner. Elaine, what, as well as your fabulous book, High Performance Through Happy People, which is magic, people, anyone who's interested in driving culture as a way of driving good profit and commercial success should pick it up and read it. Some great stuff in there. But what other books have you read along the way that have had an impact on you that you think people should read?
Oh, so many. I mean, you know, like you, I'm a bit obsessed with reading and learning constantly. Yeah, there's just been so many. I mean, I do talk in my book about a lot of other people's books. I spend more time recommending other people's books, but you know, the ones that I would that I would love to kind of recommend to people is really double down on leadership. And some of the old yeah. ones are the best. You know, I think for leaders, like the five Levels of Leadership by John Maxwell is one of my favorites, because I think it's a really transparent way of people identifying where they are in their leadership journey. Are they just kind of starting out, or, you know, have they kind of progressed? And I do some coaching, and the first thing I do is have those leaders identify whereabouts in those kind of five levels they are, which I just find really simple. I love the 1 Minute Manager series by Ken Blanchard. I think that's really easy way to get, you know, leaders to train their people in how doing some basic things, you know, how to set a goal, you know, how to have a difficult conversation. And I think, you know, there's just numerous gold nuggets that sit in the whole one minute manager series. And beyond that, obviously, you know, 7 Habits, I was given many years ago, and I still actually use that. I still do my quadrant planning in my diary. I've still got my paper A4 sheets that I do, you know, the importance of putting first things first. So the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, I would always recommend. And then maybe one that people may not have heard about, but I actually, and I say all the these things I do apply, is Marcus Buckingham's First Break All the Rules. I don't know whether you've heard that one.
Yeah. I remember reading that when I was a new managing director at Rackspace. And it's just, I mean, my favorite is, you know, that great managers spend all their time with their best people and not their poorest people. And that is just, you know, thinking about where do people spend their time? So often I'm sitting down with team leader or a manager in a business, and they're spending all of their time trying to get their poorest people over the line.
Oh my goodness. It drives me insane.
You know, maybe if you want to run a donkey sanctuary, that works. But if you're trying to build a high performing team, you should focus on the people who could actually win the race. So it's just transformative.
Yeah. One of my favorite activities is getting a leader to write down in order, you know, who are all the people that they spend the most time with. And then, you know, and then on one side of the sheet, and then on the other side of the sheet, you know, who's your top performer to your bottom performer, then drawing lines between them, because it quickly shows them that they're spending the most amount of their time. They call it playing favorites. You know, you need to spend the most amount of your time with your best people, because exponentially you're going to get back more. And that doesn't mean that you ignore your poor performers, but you shouldn't invest as much time in them. You're not going to get the returns.
Brilliant. Elaine, with that amazing nugget that people can go and do today, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Australia today. Thanks for being on the show.
It's a pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.